So today I have a more manageable manuscript, and I will read more from it. In general, my lecturing style is not one of reading things out. At home when I lecture, I like to speak completely freely. And I take this to be one of the lessons I've learned from Wittgenstein, maybe, to practice the spontaneity of thought and to exemplify that for in front of and with my students. I was doing a little bit of this yesterday. But I had a text, of course, that covered much of this material. I've been thinking about a question first posed by Hannah Pitkin decades ago in her book on Wittgenstein and justice. She asked then, what, if anything, Wittgenstein might have to contribute to our understanding of ourselves as political beings? Pitkin realized that her question would have no easy answer, since Wittgenstein speaks nowhere about politics in his properly philosophical writings, and his casual asides on the topic, I mean conversations, second-hand reports, and so on, are both rare and inconclusive. As you know, he sometimes makes quite reactionary remarks, sometimes not so reactionary remarks on particular political events. It is true that he was deeply concerned with matters of ethics, as the end of the Tractatus and the lecture on ethics make evident, and one might expect there to be a bridge from his ethical concerns to politics, but Wittgenstein's ethics is singularly apolitical, one can even say anti-political in character. In conversation with the clearly politically minded Russell, he recalled the word of Jesus, "What shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" And saving one's own soul, he added at the time, depended more on suffering and the power to bear it than on any positive action. He was struck at the time by a quietist and thoroughly apolitical sentiment voiced by a stage character in an Austrian play who was certain that, quote, no matter what happened in the world, nothing bad could happen to him. That thought was to sustain him later in the battles of the First World War. And 10 years after the war, he spoke of it still in his lecture on ethics as a paradigm of the ethical point of view. In the Tractatus, he had written that the will cannot alter the facts of the world. It can only give the whole world as a whole a positive or negative meaning. The ultimate ethical goal, he had concluded, was not intervention in the world in order to make it a different place, but, quote, to see the world aright. Still later, in 1931, he remarked in a kindred spirit that, quote, work in philosophy is really predominantly a working on oneself, on one's own understanding, auffassung, on how one sees things and what one demands from them. This deeply personal, visionary form of ethics appears to have little to do with social engagement and political action, with any desire to change the world. I agree nonetheless with Pitkin that Wittgenstein has lessons to teach us when we set out to think about political matters. Those are to be found, however, not in any positive political views or doctrines he may have entertained, but in Wittgenstein's thoughts on, for instance, the diversity of language games and world pictures, on the multiple uses of language and the variability of what we call meaning, on the resemblance structure of concepts, and on the web of family resemblances that social concepts exemplify in particular, on the grounding of rules in regularity and practice, on the unsurveyability of the human form of life, and on the interconnectedness of the private and the public. Even Wittgenstein's visionary conception of ethics may be of interest in this context by suggesting the corresponding possibility of a new visionary kind of politics. More important still, we may draw from Wittgenstein's insistence on the need to examine our most elementary philosophical concepts, concepts like philosophy, language, meaning, and so on, the complementary lesson that we must also attend to our elementary political concepts like politics, for instance, power, conflict, decision, deliberation, or if we want democracy, justice, liberty, equality, and so on, if we are to avoid the trap of ever more elaborate and ever more confused theorizing. Expanding on Pitkin's considerations, I've explored some of these themes in my recent book on Wittgenstein and will not say more about them at this moment. I turn here instead to the further thought that political insight is to be gained even from Wittgenstein's anti-political attitude. As political theorists and philosophers, we typically listen to those with a positive interest in politics, or even a positive engagement in politics. Yet the existence of an anti-political individuals throws a distinctive light on our political reality. It highlights that being political is just one among several forms of human existence. Politics may appear, to some of us, all-consuming at certain times, but the anti-political individual evades this being consumed in the name of holiness, or personal perfection, or science, or art, philosophy, or simply the wish for a quiet life. Politics may, the presence of such individuals forces us to realize that we are not inevitably, and thus by nature, political beings. But will anti-political individuals not always find themselves in a political world, though without perhaps recognizing its authority, or even its reality? Was Wittgenstein, with all his resistance to thinking politically, not exposed to political pressures that forced him, for instance, first into a war and later to become a British subject? The existence of anti-political individuals allows us, however, to conceive, at least as a vague possibility, also of a humanity as a whole as existing in a non-political state. And this confronts us, in turn, with the question, what contingent historical factors are responsible for the emergence of politics? What real or merely imagined needs politics serves? What effects politics has on human self-realization? Or also, in what sense politics may be a historical achievement, though perhaps always, like everything human, a flawed one? My concern today, however, is not with matters of politics. I want to instead to raise a related issue. The question is, what, if anything, Wittgenstein may have to contribute to our understanding of ourselves as historical beings? To the extent to which politics is to be thought of in terms of historically situated events and actions, and the equally historical project of their interpretation, this question bears, of course, on the one with which I started. But now it may seem that we are confronted with similar difficulties to the ones we faced when asking about Wittgenstein and politics. When it comes to matters of history, we discover once again that Wittgenstein's major philosophical writings don't address them. He doesn't, for instance, examine the history of philosophy in those writings, or look at other philosophers as historical figures. But a closer look, we notice a difference to Wittgenstein's relations to politics. His conversations and notebooks reveal a broader interest in various historical matters. For instance, his interest in reading about the history of Mexico. And his notes on Spengler's Decline of the West and Fraser's Golden Bough show him to be grappling with what are distinctively meta-historical questions. Most importantly, the course of his thinking seems to have taken him from a strictly anti-historical point of view to one that issues in a historical relativism. The question of how Wittgenstein thought about history is of the question of how Wittgenstein thought about history is of interest, among other things, because our engagement with Wittgenstein's work has turned so historical in recent decades. Brian McGuinness, Ray Monk, and many others have shown us the bearing of Wittgenstein's biography on the interpretation, the understanding of his work. We have learned increasingly to look at Wittgenstein's writings in a historical spirit. We ask ourselves when and how he wrote them. We seek to reconstruct the exact order of their composition. We collate those writings with his correspondence and conversations. We collect the reminiscences of his family, his friends, and his associates in order to probe them for what they may tell us about Wittgenstein's thought. But we engage in those labors not as mere historians of ideas, of course. Some of us may, but others not. Those who do more than that feel committed to Wittgenstein as a philosopher and to his form of philosophical thinking, and we see ourselves in some ways walking in his footsteps. But this confronts us with a dilemma. Is it possible that we have slipped into a very different un-Wittgensteinian mode of thinking, a kind of hermeneutic, interpretational, historical mode of thinking that is worlds apart from Wittgenstein's own? Can one genuinely be a Wittgensteinian historicist? And what would such a figure look like? The anti-historicist strand in Wittgenstein's thinking manifests itself most forcefully in a notebook entry from 1916 that reads, and I've used that once before as the title of an essay, "What has history to do with me? Mine is the first and only world." The remark did not make it into the Tractatus, but this does not imply that Wittgenstein had changed his mind on this point. He was, on the contrary, just as staunchly an anti-historical in the Tractatus as he had been 2 years earlier. While the book speaks in its highly condensed fashion of the structure of the world, of thought and language, of logic and mathematics, of natural science, and even of ethics, aesthetics, and language, and the meaning, and even the question of the meaning of life, it has nothing whatsoever to say about the historical dimension of human existence. The word history makes indeed no appearance in the Tractatus, and even the notion of time is mentioned only in passing. We get a vivid impression of Wittgenstein's anti-historicism from the first two sentences of the book, which say that, quote, "the world is everything that is the case," and "the world is the totality of facts." The "is" in these two sentences is evidently the same timeless, non-temporalized "is" as in the mathematical proposition that 2 is a prime number. The facts of the Tractatus are timeless, even when they involve temporal events. And our sentences that depict these timeless facts are timelessly true, or timelessly false. The states of affairs of which they speak obtain or do not obtain timelessly. The task for the philosopher, as seen from this point of view, is to determine the logical structure of the world, the logical structure of thought and language, and the logical structure of how the one maps onto the other. Time and history do not enter into these considerations. And it does not matter here that the Tractatus ultimately rejects this entire conception of philosophy, as the resolute readers of Wittgenstein have now convinced us, for even that rejection is cast in ahistorical terms. I ask then, what exactly Wittgenstein may have meant by his 1916 anti-historicist remark? As I reflect on his words, I realize that they may be understood in more than one way, not all equally conclusive, and not all compatible with each other, but all worth considering, since we should not assume that a writer has exactly one and one coherent thing in mind when he puts down his words. Wittgenstein had begun the series of notebooks from which I have quoted within days of the outbreak of the First World War, freshly enlisted as a soldier in the Austrian army. The notebook was meant to signal, first of all, his determination to continue, even in his new soldierly existence, the philosophical work he had been doing in the previous few years, to continue above all in his own mind the intricate and heated conversations he had had with Bertrand Russell, his mentor, friend, and intellectual other, and from whom he was separated now as an enemy alien. The early pages of the notebook show him indeed to be reviewing issues and questions on the logical structure of the world and the function of language he had been mulling over with Russell long before anyone had ever contemplated the coming of war. We might thus read the 1916 remark initially as an expression of Wittgenstein's determination not to be diverted from his philosophical work by the large course of history that was now threatening to sweep him up. But what philosophical work was he contemplating? In notes written for Russell in 1913, he had said that philosophy consists of metaphysics and logic, of a metaphysics that is based on logic. And in tune with Russell, and indeed the tradition, Wittgenstein had conceived of logic as something timeless, sublime, and ahistorical. We might read the 1916 remark then, first of all, also, as a declaration of the sublimity of logic. This is an old thought from the beginnings of Greek philosophy. In its name, Parmenides had argued that temporal change and a fortiori history is impossible, since what is, quote, is now, all at once, one, continuous. And the same idea had inspired later thinkers to hold that temporal historical being can be grasped only by appealing to something non-temporal and non-historical, that temporal and historical being is deficient or incomplete in character and dependent on the non-temporal. As long as we hold that logic is fundamental and logic is timeless, history will indeed appear to be something dependent and of no ultimate concern to the philosopher. Wittgenstein's picture of logic may have been derived from Frege's, who had argued forcefully that logic is concerned with timeless truths, just as Wittgenstein himself had repeated in the Tractatus. The proposition that it is written today, which appears to be variable in its truth value, is only shorthand for the timelessly true proposition that on May 7th, 2013, it is rainy in Bergen, Norway. Time is thus only a parameter in timelessly true propositions. To think otherwise would mean to give up on the fundamentality of logic and force us to conceive of logic itself in historical terms. Oswald Spengler was the first to see that point. He had tried to address it not by historicizing logic, but by doing so to mathematics. His attempt had failed, however, because it had attacked the matter in too abstract a fashion. In order to realize what he sought to achieve, we must probably first conceive of mathematics as a practice and then understand that practice historically. We must turn the philosophy of mathematics into a philosophy of the historical practice of mathematics, likewise for logic. Neither Frege nor Russell nor the early Wittgenstein managed to take those steps. But we can, of course, read some parts of the work of the later Wittgenstein as leading us along that road. If we take Wittgenstein's 1916 remark to be referring us back to the time at which he was working with Russell, another possible interpretation suggests itself. Russell had been committed to a metaphysical pluralism at the time, according to which the world consists of not further analyzable entities, logically simple objects, logical atoms. These simples had to be, on Russell's account, immediate objects of experience. Everything else was to be considered a logical construct, or, as he even said more strongly, a logical fiction. Thus, a historical person, like Bismarck, the German Chancellor, Russell said in his lectures on the philosophy of logical atomism, was just such a fiction. And presumably the same thing had to be said about history as a whole. Is it possible, then, that Wittgenstein was speaking of such a view when he wrote, "What has history to do with me? Mine is the first and only world." Some interpreters have sought to read Wittgenstein as a sense data theorist, and this might then explain the 1916 remark. I doubt that this reading is correct. But that still leaves the possibility that Wittgenstein's remark may have been meant not as expressing a view he would endorse, but as a reflection on sense data metaphysics, as expressing the realization that for the sense data theorist there is no history, that the world is only there for such a thinker himself. Wittgenstein certainly understood this to be a tempting philosophical view. In the philosophical remarks he noted in 1930, much later, quote, we as philosophers are tempted to say only the experience of the present moment has reality. And this proposition, quote, appears to contain the last consequence of solipsism. For the solipsist will be drawn to saying that, quote, a proposition like Julius Caesar crossed the Alps merely describes my present mental state. But when Wittgenstein wrote this in 1930, he was clear that this way of talking must be rejected, since the proposition does evidently not describe my present mental state, but, he says, an event we believe happened circa 2,000 years ago. I've spoken so far as if Wittgenstein's 1916 remark was harking back to ideas suggested to him by Russell before the war. But when Wittgenstein wrote those extraordinary sentences, he was in fact in a wholly different state of mind. He had passed through the hellfire of battle and had been left convinced that he would never survive the war. As a result, he was also seeing his philosophical work now in a new light. His purpose was no longer to understand the structures of world and language, thus continuing Russell's work. He was grappling instead now with what he called the problem of life. A third possible meaning emerges thus from the 1916 remark. The thought that Wittgenstein was distancing himself from his own past, from Russell and his projects, and indeed from the entire history of philosophy, and that he saw himself now left to philosophy entirely out of his own resources. Or, should we interpret his words, a fourth possibility, even more existentially, as an expression of Wittgenstein's certainty that he would not survive for long and that what counted now was not history, but the moment. Was he saying in the midst of a great historical upheaval that the world had contracted for him to this moment, to this one experience that was now his own? We can hear echoes of such a thought, perhaps still in the Tractatus, where we read that, quote, eternal life belongs to those who live in the present. But now we are in danger of reducing Wittgenstein's remark to the autobiographical. The sentence from the Tractatus just quoted points the way, however, to yet another fifth, more reflective, more philosophical reading of his remark, according to which the properly philosophical way to look at the world is not from any historical point of view, but sub specie aeternitatis. The same is suggested by another entry in the 1916 notebook, which declares, quote, the usual way of looking at things sees matters as if they were, as it were, the usual way of looking at things sees matters as it were from the midst of them. The good life is the world seen sub specie aeternitatis. The phrase sub specie aeternitatis, we have been told, is originally Spinoza's. But Wittgenstein is likely to have known it from Schopenhauer's treatise, The World as Will and Representation. Schopenhauer argues there, appropriating and going beyond Kant, that time is merely a form of intuition and can therefore not be metaphysically real. It is in this connection that Schopenhauer quotes Spinoza as saying, the mind is eternal insofar as it conceives things sub specie aeternitatis. Schopenhauer himself adds to this that the individual as such knows only particular things. The pure subject of knowledge knows only ideas. The pure subject of knowledge and its correlate, the idea, have passed out of all forms of the principle of sufficient reason, time, place, the individual that knows and the individual that is known have no meaning for them. So for the truly philosophical individual, that is the subject of pure subject knowledge, time has no meaning, right? So, Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer goes on to speak of the timeless and deep view of things as being also that of the mystics. All this chimes with Wittgenstein's words in the Tractatus. Quote, to view the world sub specie aeterni is to view it as a bounded whole. Feeling the world as a bounded whole, it is that that is the mystical. We may ask then whether it is this thought that he expressed also in the problem, in the question, what has history to do with me? Read in this way, Wittgenstein's words appear to belong to that broad movement we know as high modernism. His whole book can indeed be seen in this way, in the sparseness of its prose, its austerity, its minimalism, its deliberate avoidance of classical models and historical references, and most of all in its singular preoccupation with the notions of structure and form. It may be thought of as the philosophical equivalent of Malevich's suprematism, Mondrian's calibrated grids, and Bauhaus architecture. like them, a document of a moment in 20th century culture that is still close to us and yet no longer quite our own. Hence, that mixed feeling of familiarity and strangeness that strikes us when we read the Tractatus today. Similar to the ambivalence that overcomes us in the face of a Mondrian canvas or a Bauhaus construction. The link between the Tractatus and these other expressions of modernist aesthetics is most explicit, of course, at the house that Wittgenstein built in Vienna in the late 1920s, based on the architectural conceptions of Adolf Loos and conceived in collaboration with Ludwig Engelmann, himself a Loos student. The house reflects at the same time the philosophical ideals of the Tractatus, shunning all decorative features and breaking with the assumptions of traditional architectural theory. The Wittgenstein House seeks to achieve aesthetic goals through the relations of its structural elements alone. It proves thus to be, as one of Wittgenstein's sisters put it, not really a human habitation, but logic turned into architectural form. With the modernism of Malevich and Mondrian, the Tractatus shares moreover a distinctive turn towards the mystical and the spiritual. Attention to the pure forms of logic, to the structures of mathematics and geometry, provides the modernist with the only clue to the spiritual. For each of them, the concern with form, far from being the expression of a positivistic scientism, is meant to give access to a new spirituality cleansed of all the historical associations of traditional religion. Wittgenstein's thinking was to undergo a profound change in the late 20s and early 30s. That's true whatever we would take of the continuity of his thought. One signal of such a change was his new concern with time in both the philosophical remarks and the philosophical grammar. Another, a new interest in history, as it's made explicit by his notes on the works of Spengler and Sir James Fraser. In the philosophical remarks, he speaks of two concepts of time, physical time and experiential time. In physical time, all moments are equally present as in a film strip. In experiential time, we are by contrast always in the present as in the movie theater where we only see the presently projected image. He writes, quote, "If I compare the facts of immediate experience with the pictures on the screen, and the facts of physics with pictures in the film strip, on the film strip there is a present picture and past and future pictures. But on the screen there is only the present." And here it is important to note that the "is" in the proposition that on the film strip there is a present picture is once again the timeless "is," right? Whereas in the proposition that "but on the screen there is only the present," we find the tensed is of the moment. If on the present screen there is presently only the present picture. Wittgenstein flirts in the philosophical remarks with the idea that we might have two kinds of language at our disposal, a physical and a phenomenological language, in which we speak about time in these two respectively different ways. But he finds this ultimately unviable and concludes, "I do not now have phenomenological language in my mind as a goal." Nonetheless, there remains for him the possibility of speaking about both physical and experiential time. In experiential time, we find ourselves immersed in, quote, "in the stream of life or the stream of the world, but always only at the present moment." In experiential time, there is then, in a sense, no history, only an ever-changing past. Ever-changing present. And in physical time, there is a past, a present, and a future, but only as something static. The stream of life is there all at once, but fixed and frozen. Do we have then any experiential knowledge of history? History is available to us, Wittgenstein says, only in memory. But this memory is not a seeing of the past, or a seeing into the past. Then, quote, "How do we know at all that it is to be taken as referring to the past? We might say that in our memory we have a picture of the past. But," and I quote again, How do I know it's a picture of the past unless this belongs to the essence of a memory image? Have we, say, learned from experience to interpret these pictures as pictures of the past? We see Wittgenstein struggling here with the notions of time, past and present, experience and memory, but it is far from clear that he is reaching stable conclusions. Is that perhaps why he did not later come back to these issues? There is, however, one observation in philosophical Marx that resonates with his later thinking, and that is the idea that, quote, language unwinds in time. He adds to this that everything flows must be expressed in the application of language, and in fact not in one kind of application as opposed to another, but in the application, in anything we would ever call application of language, Anwendung der Sprache. In this he foreshadows the coming thought that instead of conceiving of language as a formal structure, we should speak out of it as a series of games played with language, in language. In developing this thought in his later writings, he has moved decisively beyond the timeless picture of language of the Tractatus. Where the Tractatus has spoken of language as a formal structure designed to map the equally formal structure of the world, Wittgenstein found himself thinking now about language as something learned, how it figures in such activities as giving orders and obeying them, making up a story and reading it, play acting, making a joke and telling it, translating from one language into another, asking, thanking, cursing, greeting, praying. He had also become alerted to the way verbal utterances intertwine with non-verbal activities, as when builders call to each other to do this or that as they are erecting a building. The outcome of this was that he began to think of language itself as an activity, of the function of language as manifold and as typically conversational rather than being an apparatus designed specifically for depicting reality, and of the foundation of language not in logic but in drilling, training, conditioning, memorizing through which it is acquired. Talk about language games would, quote, bring into prominence the fact that the speaking of a language is part of an activity or a form of life. And when he looked from this new perspective at the question how signs and sentences have meaning, the insufficiency of the formalist account of meaning of the Tractatus now struck home to him. Meaning could certainly not be reduced to mapping relations between two formal structures. Instead, if we had to name anything which is the life of a sign, we should have to say that it was its use, as he said in the Blue Book. The timeless picture of language of the Tractatus had thus given way to one in which time figures essentially in processes of learning, in conversational exchanges, and in the embedding of language in non-linguistic activities. If meaning is used, then the meaning of our words has an inherently temporal dimension, insofar as the use of something always occurs in time and is always extended through time. Wittgenstein's philosophical investigations begin accordingly with considerations about how language is acquired. The first section of the book contains a paradigmatic illustration of how words are used in elementary situations. I said something when I'm shopping, I give him a slip of marked 5 red apples, he takes the slip to the shopkeeper who opens the door marked apples, then he looks up the word red in the table and finds a color sample opposite. Then he says the series of cardinal numbers up to the word 5, and for each number he takes an apple of the same color as the sample of the drawer. You know this passage very well. But think about it. The story involves, in fact, 8 distinct steps, 8 different moments in time. The explanation of how the word 5 red apples have meaning for us has thus become completely temporalized. But to recognize the temporal dimension of language and meaning is not the same as taking a historical view of language or human life. When we read Wittgenstein's philosophical investigations, we are struck by his continuing lack of attention to language as a historical phenomenon. The language games he considers are for the most part abstract and almost always invented, not samples of actual historically actualized uses of language. Wittgenstein strives to give, as he said at some point, a natural history of language, of commanding, questioning, recounting, chatting, and other such uses of language. But he is ready to invent fictional natural history. The remark testifies to Wittgenstein's continuing abstract view of language. What is more, the term natural history has in this context no firm temporal connotations. Instead of natural history, Wittgenstein could also have said phenomenology. Wittgenstein never became a historical writer in the way some of those who consider themselves his former followers now are. He certainly became neither a historian of philosophy nor a dedicated philosopher of history. But we can't overlook his interest in some historical writings and his interest also in some meta-historical questions. Of particular importance is here his fascination with Spengler's Decline of the West, whom he lists as one of the 10 thinkers who influenced him. But what exactly did he take from Spengler? It was surely following Spengler that he wrote in his last notes of world pictures as giving our individual acts and utterances their meaning. The possession of such a world picture, Spengler had considered far from universal, however. He had talked of children and, quote, primitive man as lacking as yet such a thing. Only advanced cultures have a concept of world and have succeeded by means of it to construct a whole out of the mass of their heterogeneous knowledge. The resulting world picture itself manifests itself in a culture's, quote, this is Spengler now, in a culture's visible, tangible, and comprehensible expressions, acts and opinions, religion and state, art and sciences, peoples and cities, economic and social forms, speech, laws, customs, characters, facial lines, and costumes. Wittgenstein may have been particularly struck by Spengler's observation that, quote, one condition of this higher world consciousness is the possession of language. So it's language and having a highly developed language and having a world picture go hand in hand for Spengler. Meaning thereby not mere human utterance, but, Spengler said, an encultured language, Kultursprache. The possession of a Kultursprache signals the existence of a world picture. Non-historical man, so Spengler, has only a scattered set of beliefs. The possession of a single coherent picture of the world is, however, only one precondition for a historical form of existence. The world picture of historical man, so Spengler, will be one in which the world is seen as becoming, not as become, that is, as dynamic rather than as static or even timeless reality. Spengler writes, quote, historical man, as I understand the word, is the man of a culture that is in full march towards self-fulfillment. Before this, after this, outside this, man is historyless. From this there follows a fact of the most decisive importance, I'm still quoting Spengler, and one that has never before been established, that man is not only historyless before the birth of culture, but again becomes so as soon as civilization has worked itself out fully to the definitive form which betokens the end of the living development of the culture and the exhaustion of the last potentialities of its significant existence. End of quote. According to Spengler, the West has now reached the rigid state of civilization, a state in which the belief in progress, machines, and mechanical construction dominate, and the culture in its classical form has become defunct. We are familiar with such sentiments from Wittgenstein's writings about around 1931, the time when he was reading Spengler's Decline. The affinities between the two are particularly evident from his 1931 sketch for a foreword. Spengler argues furthermore that when we grow into a culture, we acquire our world picture not, quote, by definition or proof, but through feeling, experience, and intuition. He speaks of world pictures also as a mythology on which a culture is built, and here Wittgenstein appears to take him up once more when he writes later on in Uncertainty that the propositions describing a world picture, quote, might be a part of a kind of mythology. Yet there are also clearly significant differences between Spengler's and Wittgenstein's notions of world pictures. Spengler assumes that every great culture has a fixed world picture that is created at the beginning of its history, which it then develops until it is exhausted, at which point the culture reaches a state of purely mechanical existence and finally one of inevitable decline, a condition that Spengler knows as civilization. Wittgenstein was certainly in tune with Spengler's pessimism and his critique of Western culture as having reached the state of civilization, but he spoke of world pictures in uncertainty not as fixed but as dynamic entities. Quote, famous sentence, "The mythology may change back into a state of flux. The riverbed of thoughts may change, may shift." He set himself thus apart from Spengler's historical determinism and allowed for the possibility that, and this is a remark for culture and value, that perhaps one day this civilization will produce a culture. So just as culture has issued in civilization, there he is thinking like Spengler, but he's going beyond Spengler, saying this civilization may once again produce a culture. So the story is never completely settled. Instead of speaking of determinate world pictures, Wittgenstein suggested that Spengler would have done better to have spoken of family resemblances between cultural epochs and cultures themselves. In his notes on Fraser, Wittgenstein described magical and scientific culture as being held together by different webs of family resemblance and thus clearly constituting different families. In reflecting thus on historical culture, Wittgenstein rejected Fraser's attempt to think about history in causal terms. He accepted instead Spengler's morphological, or we might say typological way of thinking. This becomes evident in uncertainty with its preoccupation with the logical structure of world pictures, in which some elements are said to stand fast and to serve as axes or hinges around which other elements can turn. Interesting as this approach is, it provides us only with a limited picture of history, since it has nothing to say about the dynamical forces that drive the process of historical variation. A political history will, by contrast, be inevitably causal and genealogical in character. It needs to deal with how events bear causally on each other, how we have traveled on the road of cause and effect to the present moment, and what causal effects current events and happenings and actions may have on the future. So I'm saying, in thinking in the 1930s there in these historical terms, Wittgenstein nevertheless ends up with a picture of history, a way of thinking about history that sets aside causal considerations, and that still is a very limited way of thinking about history, one which is not enough to think about politics in a historical fashion. There's much more to be said about Wittgenstein's later work in relation to Spengler's, and I've touched upon some of these points here. I will turn back here, however, to the more specific question of the place of history in Wittgenstein's thought. I turn for this purpose to a puzzle Russell had posed in The Analysis of Mind in 1922. That book is much neglected these days, though it was of considerable significance to Wittgenstein after 1930. Just as we can understand his work up to the Tractatus only through his engagement with Russell's work from before 1914, we can fully comprehend Wittgenstein's writings from the Philosophical Remarks to the Blue Book only as a critical encounter with Russell's Analysis of Mind. So I'm saying there is this picture that when Wittgenstein returned to philosophy, came in philosophy, that he had done with Russell and was now doing something completely different and unrelated to Russell. And I think that is a deep mistake. What you have to see is that he is still very much focused on Russell in his thinking, but of course in a highly critical way, just as he had been in the Tractatus period. And that is evident from the fact that there are more or less direct references to the Analysis of Mind in the Blue Book, but there are many passages in the Philosophical Remarks, as well in the Blue Book, which clearly are in some sense engaging with Russell and Russell's view of language and meaning and thought in the Analysis of Mind. So if you think, for instance, that Wittgenstein's great new discovery in the Blue Book or Blue Book period is that meaning is use. You will be surprised to find that Russell already had expresses that same idea in 1922. Right? So far from this being sort of a radical break, it in fact relates him back to Russell, though Russell in that book then qualifies this remark, but he does express that view already and endorse it to some extent. So Analysis of Mind ought to be read by anybody interested in Wittgenstein in the 1930s or the later Wittgenstein. So, but in the book, so in the Analysis of Mind, Russell presents us with a puzzle. According to Russell, there is no logical impossibility in the hypothesis that the world sprang into being 5 minutes ago. There is no logically necessary connection, I'm quoting here, between events at different times. Therefore, nothing that is happening now or will happen in the future can disprove the hypothesis that the world began 5 minutes ago. End of quote. It is thus theoretically possible that the past has not existed. Russell goes on to say of this hypothesis that, like, quote, like all skeptical hypotheses, it is logically tenable but uninteresting. He's considering it only, as he puts it, as a help in the analysis of what occurs when we remember. And so he engages here in an analysis of the notion of memory in relation to the past. And of course, as I've already mentioned in passing, this is an issue that Wittgenstein takes up in the remarks, where he also talks about the past is no longer there. So how, in what way does the memory give us knowledge? So he's battling with this Russellian topic there. Consider that first, so to expand on Russell's word, that the world has existed over time just as we commonly believe, and that as such it contains all the traces of the past on which we rely now to reconstruct its history. Consider next that our world has come into existence only a moment ago, but with all those apparent traces of the past. These would then be mere pseudo-traces, pseudo-relics, pseudo-fossils, pseudo-documents, pseudo-memories. But they would look exactly like their real historical traces in the first world. Would we be able to tell the difference between these two possibilities, between these two different worlds? And if not, why should we believe that the world has a history, has existed for a long time, and has not just come into existence with its pseudo-traces a moment ago? I want to call someone who denies that the world has a past at all a radical historical skeptic. There are obviously many variants on this case, since we may also assume that the world came into existence 5 minutes ago, a year ago, 100 years ago, and so on. There are thus also many variations and degrees of historical skepticism. One version of such historical skepticism is known to us as creationism. I will throw a quick glance here at the creationist debate, since it can throw light on the issues I'm concerned with. The question is, can there be conclusive evidence to disprove once and for all the creationist claim that the world has come into existence only a few thousand years ago? Can the creationist not maintain his doctrine in the face of the entire geological and fossil record? Is it not possible for a God to have created the whole world a few millennia ago and for his own mysterious reasons with a spectacular array of pseudo-traces? It should be evident that there is no way of disproving once and for all the creationist. And the same holds true, of course, for the radical skeptic, radical historical skeptic. The creationist will be able to maintain his position in the face of any possible evidence. There are, however, considerations that may undermine his position. We can point out to him, first of all, that the traces or pseudo-traces of the past contain references to an apparent past. They seem to refer to some moment before the present world. Right? Our memories of pseudo-memories are of events that appear to lie further back than a moment ago. There exist documents that speak of events 1,000 years ago. Some of the artifacts that surround us show signs of long-term deterioration. We discover fossils buried deep under many layers of Earth. When we assemble all these pieces of evidence, we can construct a coherent narrative of a past. We should be able then to get the creationist and also the historical skeptics to grant us at least that much, namely that it is possible to construct a quasi-history or pseudo-history of the world on the basis of those traces or pseudo-traces. The second consideration is that we as historians can tell a rich story of how the present has come to be, namely in this way, why the apparent traces of the past are traces of real past, whereas the creationist will have to refer to a mysterious event that put everything in its place as we now have it, including all the things he considers to be pseudo-traces of a past that has never been. This consideration should help to weaken the creationist position, even though it cannot logically refute it. The case reveals two important things about our knowledge of history. First, that history is a domain where coherence is a decisive criterion, not perhaps of truth, but certainly of the acceptability of our claims. The past no longer exists, and we can therefore not compare currently existing traces of the past, or claims about the past, with their past. A bare correspondence theory of truth is of no help here. History is also, second, a domain of knowledge where the existence of explanatory detail of the richness of our account is a criterion for choosing between alternative narratives. So I want to say, not only can we say to the creationist, we can tell a story of a quasi or pseudo-history, which you can't, which you must allow us, but also we can tell a richer story than you can, and that's why we prefer ours. But that's not a decisive argument. I now want to look now at the light that Russell's puzzle may throw on Wittgenstein's lack of concern with history as he voiced it in 1916. Of course, before Russell had formulated his puzzle, and before Wittgenstein would have thought about it. The puzzle brings out that all the evidence we have of the past derives from something that exists currently. We envisage the past as a temporal sequence, but are forced to determine the nature of that sequence by considering something that exists not as a temporal sequence, by considering a concurrent reality, such as a written document now before us, in which all the words are there on the paper at one and the same time. What we have as traces of the temporal historical process are things that have a concurrent present reality. We reconstruct the historical, in other words, from something that is not itself historical. And this might be taken to imply that historical knowledge is a derivative form of knowledge, and if philosophy is concerned with what is first and fundamental in human thought, as Wittgenstein certainly believed, then it will preoccupy itself not with history, but with how our current momentary reality can give us the idea of history. From this point of view, history itself may have no primary interest for the philosopher. So there may be no surprise in Wittgenstein asking, what has history to do with me? Assume that Wittgenstein knew Russell's puzzle, at least from the early 1930s onwards, when he came back to Cambridge. At least at that point, he must have read the Analysis of Mind. But he discussed this puzzle only later in life at some length. He refers to it, first of all, in part two of the Philosophical Investigations, where he writes, quote, that the sentence the earth has existed for millions of years makes clearer sense than the earth has existed for the last 5 minutes. For we do not know what observations the second sentence refers to, and what observations would count against it, whereas the first sentence belongs to a circle of ideas, Gedankenkreis, and observations that are familiar. So we can make sense, we have a set of ideas that make the thought that the earth has existed for millions of years familiar to us, whereas the proposition the earth has existed for the last 5 minutes is unconnected with this familiar circle of ideas. That's really the difference between these two claims, and that's why we choose the one proposition over the other. Interesting as this remark is, Wittgenstein does not draw further conclusions from it in the investigations. It is only in uncertainty that he takes up the issue more thoroughly, examining numerous variations of the puzzle. And let me stop here for a small aside. When we talk about these skeptical puzzles in uncertainty, we always connect these with Moore. We say he's thinking about Moore, right? These Moorean, I know that there's a hand here. What people haven't seen, haven't talked about, is in fact that many of these cases that Wittgenstein discusses of these skeptical puzzles are not to be found in Moore, but they are rather found in Russell, right? And he's discussing Russell here as much as he is discussing Moore. So considering the possibility that someone may not believe that the Earth has existed 150 years ago, he comments, quote, "It strikes me as if someone who doubts the existence of the Earth at that time is impugning the nature of all historical evidence. And I cannot say of the latter that it is definitely correct." So I cannot say of historical evidence that it is definitely correct, right? And therefore I cannot definitely determine that the person who says the Earth has not existed 150 years must be wrong, right? The decisive point is here that historical evidence may convince us that the Earth has existed for a long time, but that this will not force the skeptic to agree, because he is always free to reinterpret that evidence in a different way. Wittgenstein continues this line of thought by adding, quote, "I can imagine a man who had grown up in quite special circumstances and be taught that the Earth came into being 50 years ago, and therefore believe this. We might instruct him, the Earth has long, and dot, 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 and so on. We would be trying to give him our picture of the world. This would happen through a kind of persuasion. So we can't prove to that person, or someone who thinks that the world came into existence only moments ago, or to someone who thinks that in order to understand the world we need to not speak in historical terms, because the world is a formal structure that can be described in non-temporalized language, we can't prove to any such person that they are mistaken, for we are facing here fundamentally different world pictures. Wittgenstein adds, quote, "Very intelligent and well-educated people believe in the story of creation in the Bible, while others hold it as proven false. And the grounds of the latter are well known to the former, but presumably make no difference." That's the point. Right? "But these believers remain nonetheless unconvinced, not out of stubbornness, but because there can be no compelling argument that will force either party to abandon their view." Wittgenstein's conclusion is simple but disturbing. "The difficulty is to realize the groundlessness of our believing. In the end," he writes, "we can only say, I have some evidence, but it does not go very far, and is of a very scattered kind. I've heard, seen, and read various things." These considerations have significant philosophical consequences. They show that radical historical skepticism, and indeed all forms of historical skepticism, are logically irrefutable. And they also show that creationists cannot be refuted by logically compelling reasons. They show furthermore that anti-historicist forms of philosophical thinking, whatever their form and whatever their motivation, cannot be refuted. They also show, of course, that historical forms of thinking cannot be defeated by anti-historicism in any of its forms. We can be sure then that the long struggle between historical and anti-historical modes of thinking in philosophy and elsewhere will continue. All we can do on behalf of a properly historical and historicist view of things is to marshal our facts in such a way that we can convince others, persuade others maybe, that we have a comprehensive, coherent, and rich story to tell. They may or may not be persuaded by our endeavors. I return here at this very end point to where I started from. My conclusion is that Spengler was right in thinking that we are only contingently historical beings. Both historical and ahistorical forms of thought and historical and ahistorical forms of human existence are available to us. And if it is correct that politics is itself historical in character, then we have one more reason to for holding that our existence as political beings is also a contingent and historical fact about us. With this, we are back to the question, what we might gain or lose by being such beings. Thank you.